yeah. I'm pretty grown up nicely now.
Anita, thank you for that. And Andrew as well. If you've got a better claim to Solihull West and Shirley, 08085 909 693. We'll get you on before the end of the show. And you could end up with a rosette and a certificate. Up next, what's Liz Truss really up to? We'll do that on Five Live.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
A very good afternoon to you, Matt. I'm coming to you live from the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. On the way, Shadow Foreign Secretary Andrew Mitchell on the situation in the Middle East. We'll speak to two Tory MPs who lost their seats in July and ask what went wrong and why were people queuing up to see Liz Truss. We'll find out after the news with Johnny Freeman.
Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon. The actor Amanda Abington says she feels vindicated after the BBC apologised to her over allegations she made about her Strictly Come Dancing partner. The corporation's upheld some of the complaints against Giovanni Panice, who'd been accused of being abusive, cruel and mean. Mr. Panice has always denied the claims. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe is following the story.
BBC Studios, which is the production arm of the BBC, has concluded that her concerns, complaints were in part upheld. They have apologised for Amanda Abington, but not wholly. So the question we understand is probably that it's a matter of verbal abuse, bullying and harassment that they've upheld, but nothing suggesting any physical abuse.
Israel's defence minister has met troops near the country's northern border with Lebanon. Speculation over a possible ground offensive against Hezbollah grows. Earlier, Yoav Gallant said the military would use forces from the air, sea and land in its fight against the Iranian-backed groups. Hezbollah says it is ready for a potential invasion. Lamar Amin lives close to an area of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which was targeted by an Israeli airstrike overnight.
I stayed awake the whole night to check if they're gonna maybe bomb another place. At the moment in Beirut, when we hear the bombing, the building will be shaking as if like there's a non-stop earthquake under you. You're scared.
Four Metropolitan Police officers and a member of staff are facing disciplinary proceedings over their alleged failures to take action against a former officer. David Carrick was jailed for at least 30 years last year for raping 12 women while serving with the force. Tom Tugendhat has praised Boris Johnson's initial response to the coronavirus pandemic in a speech at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. He's standing to replace Rishi Sunak as leader alongside Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jemrick and James Cleverly. Earlier, former Prime Minister Liz Truss called on all four candidates to acknowledge how bad things are in the UK. Tata says it remains committed to replacing a coal-fired blast furnace at the UK's largest steelworks in Port Talbot with a greener electric one. The company's spoken on the final day of production at the site in South Wales before major work begins. More than 2,500 staff are losing their jobs. And auctioneers reckon a boxing glove used by Muhammad Ali more than six decades ago could fetch a six-figure sum when it goes on sale next month. Experts have worked out the boxer wore it during a famous fight with Sir Henry Cooper at Wembley in 1963. That is the latest for now. Delith Lloyd has the sports.
Erik ten Hag has the backing of his bosses for now. The Manchester United manager will remain in charge for this week's games away to Porto in the Europa League and at Aston Villa on Sunday. The pressure, though, continues to mount with the club 12th in the Premier League following three defeats from six. Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says Ricardo Calafiori will be assessed before tomorrow's Champions League tie against Paris Saint-Germain, which you can here on Five Live. The fullback suffered a knee problem in Saturday's win over Leicester. Ben White will also have a late fitness test. And British number four, Soné Cartel's told the BBC that she's determined to make a big move up the rankings before Christmas. Cartel won her maiden WTA Tour title in Tunisia a fortnight ago, cracking the world's top 100 for the first time on the back of it.
On BBC iPlayer.
Marcus Calderwood identified me before he died.
Why did he identify you?
I don't know.
A cop who smashed his car into a guy trying to save the planet.
Allegedly, he's still entitled to a defence.
I don't think we should touch this.
Starring Michael Socca and Adil Akhtar.
Before we go to court, is there anything I need to know?
The new series of Show Trial.
I'm Officer X.
Watch all episodes from this Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. The voice of the UK. Matt Shawley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
A very good afternoon to you, Matt Shawley, coming to you live from the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham, where Tom Tugendhat's now been speaking for more than an hour about Tom Tugendhat. Let's just dip in to see what he's saying.
Exactly. Not misreporting, but they're sometimes difficult to understand or difficult to explain. So I'm not going to second guess everything. But what I will say is that if somebody ever, ever took 200 Brits hostage or fired missiles at the United Kingdom, I would not rest until that organisation was destroyed. Okay.
So that's Tom Tugendhat there, clearly reflecting on the situation in the Middle East. And I'm now joined by Conservative Shadow Foreign Secretary, former Cabinet Minister Andrew Mitchell's here. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Just your up-to-date assessment on the situation in the Middle East right now and the efforts to get Brits out of Lebanon.
Well, I think the efforts to get Brits out of Lebanon, Matt, is well advanced. The Foreign Office has a very strong and good plan. It involves using the British military forces and the Royal Air Force from RAF Akrotiri on Cyprus. So I am confident that the British government will look after its nationals and help its citizens who want to leave Lebanon. In terms of the wider situation, which you mentioned, it is clear that Israel has the right of self-defense. Hezbollah has been lobbing rockets and missiles across the border into northern Israel, and Israel is defending its people, tens of thousands of whom have had to move south. It's defending its people from those rocket attacks, and I don't think we should show any surprise, as Tom Tugendhat has just said on the clip that you showed, that if it was him, he would not allow this to happen and would not rest until it had been stopped, and that is the position of Israel.
The position that Israel has a right to defend itself and it has a right to try and get its hostages back. Has there been anything in the past, almost now 12 months since the Hamas attack, that's made you think they've actually gone beyond self-defense into excessive aggression?
Well, it's an important point, and Britain, that is to say Rishi Sunak and David Cameron and I, were very outspoken with Israel about the importance of getting aid into Gaza and of course about getting the hostages out and the treatment of detainees and other issues. So we were always clear and outspoken, but I do think that Israel has the right of self-defense. It must carry that out within international humanitarian law. And you know, when it comes to arms embargo and things like that, I reflect the fact that Britain, its own military personnel, its own weapons were being used to protect Israel from attacks by Iran just a few weeks ago. And we must remember that Israel is a democracy in the Middle East. It's a staunch ally of Britain. And we must treasure those relationships and use them to ensure that when we think their policies are questionable, we say so. And it's much easier if you're a candid friend to do that.
Explain to people listening to this who might not follow all the ins and outs of what's going on in the Middle East. Why is Britain involved, getting involved in seemingly a conflict, a complicated conflict, being played out a long way from here? Explain to listeners why you see it's important that Britain is a friend to Israel rather than an independent bystander who could see that actually awful things are happening on all sides.
Well, I think that this is a point where the world is more dangerous than it's been at any time in your or my lifetime. And there are appalling things happening in Ukraine. There is war again in Europe. The Middle East is on the edge of a major regional conflagration. That's why all of us are trying to ensure that people draw back from that. But when it comes to the right of self-defense, Israel has that right, and we must honor and respect it. And after all, Hezbollah and Hamas are proxies for Iran. They are cancers within their communities, inflicting enormous peril, misery and death and destruction on the people around them, as well as on their enemy Israel. And the wisest thing that could happen now is for Hezbollah to accept the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701 and withdraw all its people behind the Litani River in southern Lebanon. But if you ask why it matters to Britain, firstly, we live in a globalized world where the impact of these conflicts affects us here at home. And also, Britain has always been an immensely important part of the international rules-based system. Our diplomats in New York and in Geneva, they are absolutely critical to the working of that. And all of us need the international rules-based system if we are to conquer the problems that beset us, whether it's migration or whether it is pandemics, or whether it is climate change. On all those things, we need international cooperation. nation, and Britain is a big part of that system.
What do you make of the latest developments we saw over the weekend when Israel killed the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah? Today, the deputy leader of Hezbollah said it's ready for an Israeli ground offensive. Would Israeli boots on the ground in Lebanon still, from your perspective, Conservative Party's perspective, pass the test of self-defence? Or is that actually going beyond that as a move as being too aggressive?
I think the ball is in Hezbollah's court. It's very hard to argue that the world is not a better place following the assassination by the Israelis of their leader. You will recall that both ISIL and Al-Qaeda, once their leaders had been removed, ceased to be such strongly functioning organizations as they were before. And my view of your question is that the ball is in Hezbollah's court and that they should withdraw in the way that I described.
But if they don't, should Britain support Israel sending troops into Lebanon?
Well, the Israel will only do that if they are unable to ensure that Hezbollah ceases to be a threat. They will then be governed by international humanitarian law. I think it is, in those circumstances, it is highly likely it would be self-defense. But that depends on what Hezbollah do now. And we should be very clear, under the last government, and I believe under this government, we have Israel's back, and we will not allow Israel to be pushed into the sea as many of its enemies wish it to be.
Have you seen anything, and I mentioned before you were the Cabinet Minister for International Development, you were the Foreign Office as well. Have you seen anything from the Labour government's approach to this that would have is materially different to what would have happened if you'd still been in the government as a Conservative government? Has there been any big change, good or bad, that you've recognised?
Well, I think that the new government has been very keen to do everything it can to get the hostages back, to try and make sure that we get aid into Gaza, where people are suffering terribly there, and that's all a continuation of policy. And it's the job of the opposition, really, to try and support, particularly in foreign affairs, what is in Britain's interests. And I think, to that extent, there's a lot of continuity. I don't think we would have imposed any form of arms embargo, not least, as I said, because just a few weeks ago, British weapons and British service men and women were in action defending Israel against these outrageous Iranian attacks.
Well, obviously, we'll keep a close eye on what's happening there. It's an evolving situation. We'll have more on that later here on 5 Live, no doubt, during Drive as well. Let's come back to where we are here at the Conservative Party conference. I mean, it's the same question that everyone is sort of asking, but what is your assessment of why the Conservatives lost and lost so badly in July this year?
Well, I think that is probably a longer discussion than we're about to have now. But the we've been in power for 14 years. In Britain, you know, governments don't win 5 elections on the trot. I think that we had
the Conservatives have never lost as badly as you lost this year.
But we've had to deal with some incredibly difficult issues. COVID, where I think actually, you know, Rishi Sunak did a brilliant job in terms of saving people's jobs and livelihoods and protecting families, but cost an enormous amount of money. And we saw, you know, rising demands for public expenditure, but a desire by the party to reduce taxation that wasn't possible. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned, and there's a lot of work being done now to make sure that we do learn those lessons. But the point I would make is this, that the Conservative Party has been in the past one of the, if not the, most successful political organisations at winning government and winning power in the Western world. That has been the case because we seek to serve the British people. We are a party that understands the importance of getting the right policies and delivering service. We are the servants, not the masters of the people. And I'm sure that we will relearn that lesson and have appropriate policies to tackle the issues of today. What Labour is now discovering is that all their glib comments in opposition, now that they are at the chalk face of having to tackle and grasp these problems, is not as easy as it looks.
It's interesting you talk about the pandemic as being part of the cause. Actually, the truth is that during the pandemic, Boris Johnson was riding high in the polls. The rollout of the vaccine was incredibly popular. The way that he took us through the lockdowns remained incredibly popular. Keir Starmer only went up in the polls, I think, when he was told to self-isolate because he had COVID. The truth is, the reason you then went down in the polls was because people were unhappy about Partygate. They were unhappy, your own colleagues were unhappy with his handling of things like the Chris Pincher story and so on. Then you had a Prime Minister who only lasted 6 weeks, and then you had another Prime Minister who just couldn't keep the show on the road. That's why you lost the election, not because of the pandemic.
Well, I think the pandemic dictated a lot of the financial consequences, which we then had to wrestle with. But on I'm leaving aside your point about Boris and about Liz Truss. Rishi got the hospital pass. Rishi was the person who cleaned up the mess.
He got the hospital pass from Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. You can't leave them aside.
Yes, no, I'm just defending Rishi, who I think was a good prime minister. And I think history will treat him a lot better than some of his contemporaries. He definitely got the economy onto the right track. The reason we have remarkably low inflation now, the reason why we have the best growth performance in the G7, these are a result of the success of Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak working together in the interest of the British economy. And I think that as time goes by, people will recognise that.
So we've got Kemi Badenoch on the stage now doing one of her in-conversation fireside chats. Who do you think can defy history and turn the worst result you've ever had into being back in government next year? Have any of the four candidates got it for you?
Well, all four of them are friends of mine. I think they all have tremendous virtues.
I could say that about lots of friends of mine, but I wouldn't say they should be prime minister.
I honour and respect their bravery in seeking to take over this role. I'm part of the reason I'm here is do my job as shadow foreign secretary, sign a few copies of my book. I hope your book is selling well as well.
It was doing very well earlier on. Yes.
No, well, I think it's a good trade at the bookshop for both of us. We authors must stick together, you know. But I'm here to listen to what all four of them say.
You don't sound very impressed by any of them, Andrew.
No, that's quite wrong. I'm here to listen to all four of them because I want the next leader of the Conservative Party not just to be our Conservative leader, I want them to be the next Prime Minister. And if the Labour Party go on letting down people and doing such a terrible job as they're doing at the moment, I'm absolutely confident that any one of these four ought to be able to win the next election and replace Keir Starmer's premiership.
So who are you backing?
So I'll let you know after the conference.
What do you think you're going to find out from them over the next 2 days that you don't already know, given that you sat in the cabinet with them, you've known them for years, you know they've been talking endlessly for the last, 6, 7, 8 weeks. What is it that you don't yet know?
Do you know, in 2005, I ran the leadership campaign of one David Davis, and we arrived at the party conference confident of victory, miles ahead amongst members of Parliament. We left the conference 3 days later after there was intensive exposure of both David Davis and David Cameron, and David Cameron was in the lead. I think that the process at this conference of these 4 days is incredibly important in allowing the members of our party, the members of Parliament, councillors, to see and watch them in action and then reach the right decision at the end of that time when they come to vote.
Tom Tugendhat has been talking about his military record. He's shrugged off questions about his inexperience in government and pointed out he's got experience in the military as well. I'm not going to hold against anybody their inexperience in combat or their inexperience in foreign affairs, he said. Asked by Chris Hope, who was a spy, he said he was a uniformed intelligence officer. Does that mark him out, Tom Tugendhat, his military experience?
I think he's a very strong candidate indeed. I know him very well. He was a distinguished soldier. He was a fabulous colleague in cabinet. He worked enormously hard on keeping us secure. He's a very strong candidate.
But you're going to tell me that Kemi, James and Robert are also very strong candidates.
Well, it depends on what you ask me, but I shall...
Are they all strong candidates?
They're all very strong candidates.
Who is the weakest of the strong candidates?
You'll have to ask me this after the conference.
OK, well, we shall. We'll come back. Andrew Mitchell's good to see you. Shadow Foreign Secretary joining us on Five Live this afternoon. In a moment, we're going to turn our attention to Liz Truss. Were you pleased to see Liz Truss here, Andrew?
I haven't seen her.
Well, no, but she's here at the conference. Do you think is she a useful adornment to the conference?
If I see her, I'll shake her warmly by the hand and ask her how she's getting on.
Very good.
She's another author who's selling her book.
Stop talking about books. Right, anyway, we'll find out what happened with Liz Truss in a moment. Now let's turn our attention to another one of the very strong candidates, as Andrew described him. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, taking us through the runners and riders of the Tory leadership. Here's his take on Robert Jenrick.
Robert Jenrick has come top in both MPs' votes so far. That probably makes him the favourite. He's running from the right. He's backed by several of the Conservatives' leading right-wingers because of a focus on cutting immigration, including by leaving the European Convention on Human Rights. Jenrick's been on a journey. He was once very close to Rishi Sunak, but quit as his immigration minister because he thought he wasn't willing to go far enough. He's been an MP since 2014 and is 42. He was the first millennial cabinet minister as Boris Johnson's housing secretary. He thinks more needs to be done to get young people on the housing ladder.
Thanks so much, Henry. He'll be back in another half an hour completing the set. But now, we've talked a lot about her already on the show today, Liz Truss, here at the party conference. She's the only one. Rishi Sunak was obviously here as a former Tory leader. Liz Truss was here. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Let's just dip into Kemi Badenoch, one of the runners and riders, doing her sort of Q&A in conversation. Let's take a listen to what she's saying.
Where she was asked the question, she said there's no such thing as society. She was talking about people wanting government hands out, that they're only individual people and families. And that very good explanation got cut down into a soundbite that was used to attack her. When you are a leader, when you are a conservative, when you are making the argument for conservative principles, your opponents are going to try and turn it into something else. We need to decide who's going to be leader of the party. Not the left, not the Guardian, not the BBC, just conservatives.
There we are. Always good for the BBC to get a mention. We'll come back to that. It's coming back to not there on stage. So let's turn our attention to Liz Truss. She turned up today to do an in-conversation with the Telegraph's Tim Stanley, her only appearance at the Tory party conference this year. And I have to say, there was a big old queue to get in to see her in Hall 5 here in the conference centre in Birmingham. So I went down to catch up with the hordes of people to find out why they were in the queue.
Hello. I'm from Five Live. Why are you queuing up to see Liz Truss?
We didn't get to see her last year. The queue was too long.
What do you want to hear from her?
Something. Anything. I just want to hear her speak. I want to watch. I don't know what she's doing now. It'd be good to hear an update from her.
Are you a fan?
I did vote for her.
Do you have any regrets about that?
No.
Okay, very good. Nice to see you. What about you? Why are you queuing up?
I was actually just eating my lunch. I wanted a place to stand and eat my sandwich.
It's her birthday today,
buddy. Happy birthday. What a way to spend your birthday listening to Liz Truss. Why are you queuing up to see Liz Truss?
For a bit of entertainment, I think.
A bit of entertainment? You've just come for a laugh?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. To get a bit of perspective on, you know, how she feels the party's going and hopefully her thoughts on the leadership contest too.
Very good. Well, we'll wait and see. Nice to see. Hello, sir. Can I ask you why you're queuing up to see Liz Truss?
I'm not going to answer that.
You're not going to answer that? Why, is it too embarrassing? Okay. Why? Can I ask why you're queuing up to see Liz Truss?
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm just interested to see her, you know?
Okay, very good. Hello, why are you queuing up to see Liz Truss?
I'll see what she's got to say.
Are you a fan?
Not really.
Right. No, that's fair enough. Why are you queuing up? You're a fan. Why are you a fan? What's the point of standing in a great big long queue to see someone who lasted 6 weeks as Prime Minister?
Well, someone important in history.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, she has got a place in history. Do you think she's got anything? Do you think she's got anything useful to say for rebuilding the Conservative Party?
In a way, yeah. She was elected by the members.
Yeah. Was that a mistake?
No.
Even though she didn't last 6 weeks?
No, I still don't think it was a mistake. I think she was hard done by. She didn't do everything brilliant. She could have done things a lot better. I think she'd say that, okay. But I do think she was hard done by in the end.
Hello, why are you queuing up to see Liz Truss?
So I know her.
You do?
Yeah.
And you're a fan?
Yeah, I am, yeah. I've met her about 3 or 4 times. Yeah. And she's a nice person.
What can she usefully add to the current debate in the Conservative Party, given that some people think she's part of the reason why you lost so badly?
I think she was set up, but, you know, she's got a story to tell, and I think she should be allowed to say it. Tell it.
Very good. Nice to see you. Thanks so much for that. Hello, can I ask why you're queuing up to see Liz Truss?
Something free entertainment, see what silly things she has to say.
Are you a fan?
Absolutely not. No.
You've just come for the lols?
Yes, exactly. See what silly things she has to say, see if she hasn't disgraced herself enough.
Is it helpful for the Conservative Party, her being here?
I think she's got no shame, and it's completely... It takes the focus of what we're here to do and decide our future direction. She's the past, we're going forwards.
So that's quite a mixed bag of views. There were several other people who were just there for lunch. There were an awful lot of journalists as well, it has to be said, in the queue. So this is what happened at the Liz Truss event. She was asked by Tim Stanley if she would have done better than Rishi Sunak if she had led the Conservatives into the general election?
When I was in number 10, Reform was polling at 3%.
Right.
By the time we got to the election, I think they got 18%.
Yeah.
Because we promised change that we didn't deliver. Mm. Now, of course, without the support of the parliamentary party, it was very, very difficult for me to get my changes through. And, you know, if you have people in the parliamentary party saying it's Liz Truss's fault this has happened, not the Bank of England's fault, which is what people did and are still doing, as we've just been discussing, it is very difficult for me to deliver that change. But certainly, if the mini budget had been allowed to succeed, you know, we'd have lower corporation tax, bringing more companies into this country, not relocating to Ireland. We'd have, you know, duty-free shoppers coming to London rather than being diverted to Paris or Milan. We'd got on with fracking.
That was Liz Truss speaking a little earlier. So what is she up to and what impact might this have on the race to become the next leader of the Conservative Party? James Hill co-wrote Out of the Blue, the inside story of the unexpected rise and rapid fall of Liz Truss. James, she does still clearly have appeal. There were people queuing up today because they wanted to see her. They agreed with her prognosis. They were disappointed that she wasn't still part of the conversation.
Yeah, I do think that she has a certain fascination for a lot of Tory members. A lot of them voted for her. People want to hear from her, and she always has something to say, and I do think she stands for something larger than herself. That being said, of course, I'm not really sure there's going to be a Trussite agenda going forward. And the thing that struck me in terms of Liz Truss's relationship with the other four people who are all going to be Tory leader, all of whom she appointed as ministers in her government, is how little, you know, influence she seems to have on the race and how little effort they seem to be putting into winning her vote.
There was an interesting comment she made in that clip where she said she lacked the support of the parliamentary party to deliver what she wanted. Yeah. She won amongst the members, but not amongst the MPs. We could potentially be setting up for the same issue here. There were four of them on the stage seemingly endlessly. They're making their big speech on Wednesday. But then the MPs are going to whittle them down, and it's possible that the members' favourite doesn't even get to the final two. Or it's possible that whoever wins has the same problem, that they've won the Tory party membership, but not the Tory MPs who sit behind them in the House of Commons. That was clearly a problem for Liz Truss.
This has always been the issue for successive leaders on both sides of the House, which is that you win over the membership vote, but you don't win the MPs, or vice versa. And I think the thing with Liz Truss, she has definitely tried in the last couple of years to try and make the Conservative Party in Parliament much more like her own politics. So this was what PopCon was all about. Popular conservatism, explicitly going for selection of Tory MPs who would be much more like her agenda. But I think that it's going to be a case potentially where you see Kerry Badenoch, who I think most people would say probably would be the member's favourite, probably won't make the final two. And that is going to be a huge issue in terms of, I think, a couple of next years or so.
And you pointed out that she appointed all of them to government. They all, at various points, also had jobs with other prime ministers who led to varying degrees of success. Do you think ultimately that is a problem? That when you look at history where a party suffered a terrible loss, there sort of had to be a whole generational change? You know, Keir Starmer only came in 2010. Wasn't there for the sort of the Labour, you know, new Labour years. David Cameron only came in 2001, wasn't there for 1997. Yeah, the patterns are there that the ones who end up taking their parties back into government weren't there at the time of the terrible jobbing. Actually, we could be seeing a fight being played out here between four people who we still don't know possibly. The next Conservative Prime Minister might not even be an MP yet.
Absolutely, and I think that the analogy that most people keep using is 2001. 2001, of course, Michael Portillo loses out by one vote. He's the member's favourite and yet doesn't get through. And, of course, the person who's top of the MPs is Ken Clark, and he gets sort of thrashed, romped home royally by Ian Duncan Smith. And, of course, Ian Duncan Smith is not leader at the next election. So the question is, of course, is the person who wins this time, are they going to be leader in 4 or 5 years' time? And given how volatile politics is now, given how enormously annoyed a lot of MPs are, that remains to be seen, I think, Matt.
And do you think Liz Truss ever, I mean, she's not an MP now, do you think she'd ever come back?
Well, the more interesting question when Tim Stanley asked that about coming back to Parliament, I mean, which chamber? Is she going to be a peer? If I was Keir Starmer, I'd put her in the House of Lords. You know, you're going to have her as a recruiting sergeant for Labour.
Normally you're put in the House of Lords by the leader of your own party rather than
But as a former Prime Minister, she is entitled to a peerage. Yeah. And she was Prime Minister for 49 days. So she ought to be able to get that if she wants that. And I would be really interested to know if she gets asked that question, will you go to the House of Lords? Because I'm not sure any Tory leader is going to let her stand as a Conservative MP candidate next time around.
It's interesting because actually David Cameron and now Theresa May have broken this long period of former Prime Ministers not going to the House of Lords. Mm. So,
and of course, the thing Liz kept saying is, you know, the importance of those voices in the public sphere. If she believes in that, is she going to go to the Lords?
Well, there we are. You can't keep a good woman down. James, lovely to see you. James Hill there, author of Out of the Blue, the inside story of the unexpected rise and rapid fall of Liz Truss. Lots of you are getting in touch about Liz Truss. Not huge fans, lots of you. My three-year-old is more capable of taking responsibility than she is, says someone on the WhatsApps. Others saying that we should stop mocking her and she had an appeal, and as James is pointing out, she won the vote amongst the members, and some of them are still very cross that she's not still there. 85058 if you want to get in touch, 08085 909693 on the WhatsApps. We're still looking for someone with the best claim to Solihull West and Shirley to become a member of Matt's Parliament. Kev says, I went to Solihull Ice Rink when I was 10 on a school trip. It was the day John Lennon died. I went outside to eat my chips and I couldn't get back in. I had to stand outside for an hour until the coach arrived. It was freezing. That's the sort of claim, the best claim, connection to Solihull West and Shirley. We'll get you on before the end of the show. And yes, you'll get a certificate and a rosette in five live colours, which Big Boss Johnny tells me are on the way. Talking of on the way, we'll speak to two MPs who lost their seats in the general election to find out if they've got their own assessment of what went wrong. And we'll speak to the man in charge of the contest to elect the next Tory leader and ask, is it just going on too long? That's after we get a news update from Johnny Freeman.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks, Matt. Good afternoon. Hezbollah says it is ready to respond to a potential ground invasion by Israel in Lebanon. Speculations growing after Israel's defence minister Yoav Gallant met with troops near the border earlier. Downing Street has said the government's support for Israel is ironclad, but it's called for restraint on all sides to avoid the conflict escalating. The BBC has apologised to Amanda Abington and upheld some of the complaints about her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Panice. The actor says she feels vindicated by the decision made following a review. Mr. Panice has always denied the claims. Kemi Badenoch began making her pitch to be the next Conservative leader at the party's conference in Birmingham. Earlier, her fellow contender Tom Tugendhat said he'd work to rebuild trust. Robert Jemrick and James Cleverly are also standing to replace Rishi Sunak. A new figure show UK house prices have gone up. The Nationwide Building Society's found there's been a 3.2% increase in September compared with a year ago. That is the latest for now. Delith Lloyd has the sport.
Erik ten Hag looks set to stay in charge of Manchester United for this week's matches, despite a miserable 3-0 defeat at home to Tottenham. United face two tough away trips this coming week. Pressure is mounting on the Dutchman, with the club lying 12th in the Premier League. BBC Sports chief football reporter Simon Stone says a lot will depend on the upcoming results.
I've been told that they are supportive of him, but like any football manager, you have to deliver results. They play Porto on Thursday in the Europa League. They are away at Aston Villa, who are an exceptional team, on Sunday. I would imagine Manchester United, if those two games don't go well, will be looking very, very hard at the situation that they find themselves in.
Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says Ricardo Calafiori will be assessed before tomorrow's Champions League tie against Paris Saint-Germain. The fullback suffered a knee problem in Saturday's win over Leicester. Ben White will also have a late fitness test. That match will be on Five Live Sport. Newcastle boss Eddie Howe says he has his fingers crossed that Alexander Isak could be fit to face Everton on Saturday. However, the striker who has a fractured toe could also face the prospect of being sidelined until after the international break.
It was either going to be he was going to be out for probably until after the international break initially, or he could carry on playing as normal if he could tolerate the feelings and the effects of the injury. Now, he hasn't been able to do that, so we're back to the original diagnosis, I think.
One game in the Premier League this evening as Bournemouth host Southampton. Bournemouth's head coach Andoni Iraola won't be in the dugout, though, as he's serving a one-game touchline ban after accumulating three yellow cards. Saints will move out of the drop zone with a victory. Their boss, Russell Martin, meanwhile, is impressed with the job Iraola has done with their opponents.
He's done a brilliant job, a really, really brilliant job, but it took him some time. In the same way, it's taken us a bit of time to adapt and adjust. So they had a bumpy start under him, Andoni, and then they've been brilliant ever since, and they've not looked back, and they've just kept building on it and building on it, and they have real clarity, which is gives them so much strength, and they've recruited really well.
British tennis player Sonai Kartal is hoping to continue her rise up the world rankings, despite fearing in January that she wouldn't be able to play again this season because of a health issue. The 22-year-old has instead enjoyed the best season of her career, reaching the Wimbledon third round, winning her first WTA title and breaking into the world's top 100.
People were saying, like, you know, you've reached top 100, like, you can kind of chill out. But I was like, no, like, I want to, you know, I always want to push for the next best thing. So, yeah, it will be just trying to get as high as those and see if I can even go top 80, top 70 by kind of December.
Elsewhere, Jack Draper has withdrawn from this week's Shanghai Masters following his retirement from the Japan Open over the weekend.
Good morning, Five Live Breakfast with Rick and Rachel.
Five Live Breakfast.
Every weekday morning from 6.
Wake up to the latest news.
Updates from the world of sport.
And of course we hear from you in My Opinion.
Our In My Opinion today is all about tracking your children.
Pippa says, no complaints from anyone other than when my son can see we're still in the pub when we should be home with his takeaway.
There might be some situations where parents think it's a good idea.
Ian says, never tracked ours, will only cause more worry. I know friends that do and their kids are mega soft mardy pants.
Five Live Breakfast.
With Rachel Burden and Rick Edwards.
It's weekdays from 6 on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us.
Matt Shawley.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, very good afternoon. Matt Shawley live from the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. Now, there's been this sort of story swirling around for the past couple of days. Who made donations worth £75,000 to Robert Jenrick, one of the Tory leadership contenders, in July? Well, now the businessman, Philip Ullman, has said he is the source. After Robert Jenrick faced questions about the money, which was listed as being from the company The Spot Fitness, Philip Ullman said he didn't want there to be any suggestion at all that I'm hiding anything. And he understood the importance of donor transparency. It came after the Labour Party. There were questions to answer about where the money had come from, because there were questions about how many people actually worked for this company and did it exist and what the point of it was. Yesterday, Robert Jenrick said the donations have been perfectly legal and valid, but now the businessman, Philip Ullman, has outed himself as the man behind those donations. So be interested to see if there's any reaction, more reaction from Robert Jenrick, or indeed those he is running against for the leadership. We'll find out about the timing of it. Even some of the candidates are saying they think the leadership contest should be a bit shorter. We'll speak to the man in charge of that in this half hour. But first, yeah, it's the X Factor, where we speak to two ex-MPs to get their take on what is going on. And because we're at the Conservative Party, because we've got two former Conservative MPs, Miriam Cates and Tobias Elwood, are both here. How are you?
Good.
Good afternoon.
What's it like? Is it better or worse being here as a non-MP, Miriam?
I think, actually, the fact that we're not in government makes more difference to the conference than yes or no as
to you
an MP.
Personally, yeah.
I mean, it's only actually my, I think, fifth conference, because I joined the party in 2018, and then we didn't have a conference COVID year.
Yeah.
So I'm a relative newbie still to conferences.
What about you, Tobias?
So last year's conference was dour. There's no doubt about it. An election coming up. It's like a dentist trip that we know we're going to have to go to. Labour was apparently very upbeat. I didn't attend. This time it's turned on its head. You've got Labour that's now understanding, coming to terms with the burden of office, and has made some errors themselves. Whereas we've been to the dentist, we recognise that we can now move forward, and there's certainly a buzz to this particular conference because there's.
You sure the buzz isn't still the dentist drill?
It probably might
be.
Novocaine still wearing off. Perhaps that's it. But no, certainly that this debate taking place. Where should the party go to? What's our sense of purpose? What do we stand for? What slice of the spectrum are we wanting to occupy? And the four candidates selling, putting their stalls out.
Do you think, I mean, you talk about the buzz. It does seem a bit odd, this sort of giddy playing pop music and all smiling and all. To have lost as badly as you did just a couple of months ago, the idea that a new person with a new jingle is going to turn things around, I mean, it's a bit odd being giddy, isn't it? Miriam?
Well, I mean, there are two aspects to that. Firstly, you know, this is an annual conference that people look forward to. I think Conservative members across the country who perhaps don't get as much say on the media and in obviously Parliament do have an opportunity to meet people who are making policy to discuss these things. So, of course, there's a buzz. That's a natural human phenomenon. But also, I think there's an element of relief. I mean, we knew we were going to lose the election. We've been in power a long time. I think there was a sense that we didn't know what we were going to do next. This is the time to rebuild. And I think the other thing is we're looking at Labour, as Tobias said, they're not doing very well in the polls. They don't have any answers. They've basically come into power on the back of not being Tories. And so actually there is an opportunity for us to provide some answers. And I think there is a sense of positivity in that, because at least we can see a path now, potentially back to re-election, but we better make sure we've got some answers when we get there.
I was supposed to ask you about who are you backing?
I am not publicly backing anybody.
No, I've offered advice if they're interested in it.
I keep asking people. Everyone says there's a buzz and it's all marvellous and we're all going to get back after 5 years. Then I ask, well, who do you think is going to do that? And no one will say.
That's the process. So you want to jump ahead. We're still learning. But
you know, you sat with these people in the Commons for years. You know who they are.
Yeah, but we're just ordinary members now.
Mere members of the public.
Also, they're now crafting their message. They're setting out their store. And as I say, and not to dismiss your important point, where we were at the last election, the lessons to be learned are enormous, and they of course have done their homework or doing their homework to then make their case as to how we do rebuild, rejuvenate and advance and have something plausible to say at the next general election.
I want to play you a clip because I asked about half an hour ago, we had Andy Street here, former Conservative Mayor of the West Midlands. I asked him who he was backing. You wouldn't say, but he did say this.
The real issue is who has the leadership ability to assemble a set of answers around those bread and butter issues, which is where the election will be. What does Keir Starmer keep saying? He's right. He keeps saying it's all about growth, it's all about the economy, and it's also about trust. He's also right when he says it's about a service government. So what we've got to do is, which character has the ability to do that and has the ability to assemble the policy platform?
He went on to also say, just going on about the ECHR is not where the general public are. Do you agree with that, Miriam?
Well, I do and I don't. I think some of these arguments about the practicalities of how we deliver a particular policy, let's say we want to lower immigration or we want to end illegal immigration, let's say, most people would agree with that. How you actually go about doing that perhaps is not what's going to set the media alive.
But actually the problem is that some people
important.
Have said that the successive Conservative Prime Ministers, but particularly Rishi Sunak, it was one of his five pledges. The moment he started going on about the boats, reform went up in the polls. Because you put a spotlight on an issue that was incredibly complicated, made it sound like there was a simple solution, and then you failed.
But the problem is that for far too long, the elites have not talked about the concerns of ordinary people.
No,
whether that is immigration,
people
whether that's family.
People have been talking about immigration.
No, they haven't.
I've been covering politics for 20 years, and they've talked about little else.
Until very recently, it has been completely verboten to say immigration's too high.
Banged on about immigration in 2005.
It was certainly not a mainstream argument before reform started to appear again. Now, you know, there are loads of different arguments around immigration, but for too long, ordinary people have felt like their concerns, whether that's over immigration or other things, have been dismissed by the elites, who have either said, no, it's not too high, don't be so ridiculous.
Was it Theresa May with the go-home vans? Was it David Cameron saying you wanted to bring net migration down to the tens of thousands?
The makeup of views in Parliament is very much at odds with the views in the country as a whole. Look at Brexit as a core example. 52-48 in the country.
Much
the vast
debate
majority
that was,
of MPs
that was what, eight years ago.
Yeah, but the makeup of Parliament and the kind of viewpoints of MPs has not changed. They are more liberal, more middle class, and more educated than the population as a whole.
But you said the elites have stopped us having a conversation about immigration.
They have.
If you just look at the history of politics of the last 20 years, that's just not true.
I'm not saying nobody's mentioned the word immigration. I'm saying the kind of granular discussion we're having now about the fact that it matters which country people come from, that it matters that there's been huge change in our culture. Those things were actually fairly unsayable just a few years ago, until the culture changed slightly. Reform started to produce some competition. Boris Johnson was perhaps more open about these issues, although, you know, completely failed to control immigration. And I think, you know, that Brexit was this release valve where for a long time the concerns of ordinary people in constituencies like my former constituency had not been heard or listened to. People had been looked down upon, told they were stupid or racist for raising ordinary concerns. And that's why Brexit happened, and that's why there still is an unsettlement in this country, because people don't feel listened to.
So we need to craft policy that's relevant for 5 years from now, not for today, because nobody is listening to us. And Britain will be very different economically, digitally, and a security perspective. Even our friends and foes could be very different as well. So us jumping onto policy right now for the today, just to perhaps to appeal to our party base, I think is a bit short-sighted. Take Brexit, for example. Do we have the courage, dare to have the courage to say, whether you're a Remainer or a Brexiteer, where we've landed, it is exactly where we want to be. Now, it comes up for review, formal review next year in 2025. Does the Conservative Party have the courage to say we can advance it, honouring the Brexit referendum, but economically actually advance a relationship with Europe that makes sense to advance growth as well, which is what we're talking about? That's going to be a brave leader to take us there. And that's, I think, my encouragement to whoever does win, is to put the nation before parties' interests. Stay professional, avoid the sort of Hunger Games approach that perhaps we must avoid, but also recognise that we need to be appealing to people half the average age of the party member if we have any hope at all of getting back in the next election.
Yeah. I mean, you're both in the same party and you sat in the same House of Commons, but you're talking about trying to placate Reform voters by moving to the right. And you're talking about trying to placate, what, Lib Dems by getting a closer relationship to your...
Do you know what's really interesting?
You're absolutely not understanding the Brexit discussion there, if that's what you think it is to out-Lib Dem.
My point is that you are coming from two different wings of the party. It's going to be a really tough job for whoever takes us over.
True,
to try and
really
come up with a platform that both
really
you will, too, will be happy
report
with.
There's a report out yesterday by Onward that looks in detail at where our voters went to the last election. What's really interesting is that although we lost similar numbers in areas to Lib Dems and to Reform, those voters have an awful lot in common with each other. They're not what you might think of as a classic Lib Dem voter or a classic Reform voter. They're people who basically were really hacked off with us and went to another party because they were fed up with us. I don't think it is actually an impossible task to win both groups back. But we have to distinguish ourselves from Reform. Now, that doesn't mean we don't talk about the same issues, because I think they are important to people. But the populist approach is to say what people want to hear. Oh, we're going to cut taxes. Oh, we're going to stop the boat. Oh, we're going to, you know, we're going to, oh, Nigel Farage, we're going to end NHS waiting lists. Now, that's equally infantilising as pretending those problems don't exist. And so what we have to do is to be honest with people and say, do you know why taxes are so high? Because we have an ageing population, half of our welfare is spent on pensions, we're not having enough children. You know, these are the reasons taxes are not high. It's not just an ideological choice. And I think that's how you treat people in a conservative but grown-up way, is to be honest about the causes of the problems, which is what Reform don't do and what the Labour Party certainly aren't doing, and that's how we find our way back.
I know you've talked a lot about the issue of we need to have more babies, the birth rate's going down, and if you want workers, we're going to pay the tax to pay for this stuff. Do you think maternity pay is excessive?
No, not at all. And I also don't think that's what Kemi Badenoch said. And I think she's been misrepresented, which I think is really dishonourable, given that she came out straight away and said, that's not what I meant. And this
She did say maternity pay varies depending on who you work for. But statutory maternity pay is a function of tax. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people and giving to another. This, in my view, is excessive.
She very much clarified that she is not against maternity pay, but it does open up a really interesting question, because yes, statutory maternity
pay... She hasn't been misrepresented. She didn't misspeak.
Well,
that is what she said.
She was talking about business regulation. Yeah. She was interrupted, and she probably answered in a slightly more clumsy way than had she prepared for that question. That's a classic humour mistake to make, and she has clarified. Yeah. I think we should honour people when they say, that's not what I meant, this is what I really meant. But, of course, statutory maternity pay is paid for by taxation, but so are pensions, and so is the NHS. And you could say, well, most people don't have statutory maternity pay, why should they have to pay for it? Well, then why should young working people have to pay for pensions? Why should young working people have to pay for the NHS costs of people who are obese or smoke? If you're going to socialise healthcare and the cost of old age, you have to socialise the cost of having children.
I should ask you both, I should have asked you probably this at the beginning, how have you adjusted to life outside the House of Commons, Tobias?
The biggest concern, reason I came into politics is because I'm concerned as to where the world's going, Britain's place in the world, and whether we're doing enough to help shape the challenges that lie ahead. those haven't disappeared at all. In fact, it's getting even more dangerous. And one thing that Conservatives can do, whether it be in opposition or indeed in government, is to help advance our defence posture, get ready for those storm clouds that are gathering again. And that's what I've been doing, is it's continuing that message. So even though I don't have the rank of MP...
You're still doing the same thing.
I'm still doing it.
Earlier, one of your former colleagues, Jonathan Gullis, was talking about how he's applied for lots of jobs and hasn't even got an interview. If you had a similar
experience...
I'm being
interviewed now.
No, I mean, for a job interview. I mean, it's not in my power to give anyone a job.
No, I am fine, thank you. I'm
you're both
enjoying
happy.
My freedom.
Good. Miriam Cates, Tobias Elwood, former Conservative MP. It's really good to see you. Completing our full set, then, of the runners and riders, this is Henry Zeffman's guide to Can We Bait or Not?
Kemi Badenoch has run for leader before. She came fourth in the 2022 Conservative leadership election, which Liz Truss won. She then served in the Truss and Sunak cabinets as International Trade Secretary, then Business Secretary. At the same time, she was Minister for Women and Equalities. She believes Conservative governments should have done more to reject what she sees as identity politics. She wants the state to focus on doing fewer things well. She's 44 and has been the MP for North West Essex since 2017.
Thanks so much, Henry. That's his full set of the runners and riders, and we'll try and track him down and get him on the show tomorrow as well. Right, we've been talking a lot about the Tory leadership contest. If you've had enough of it, spare a thought for my next guest. Bob Blackman is the Conservative MP and chair of the 1922 committee, who is running the leadership contest.
Yes, indeed.
Have you had enough of it yet, Bob?
No, we're having a very jovial contest, concentrating on what the candidates are going to do if they're leader. Fortunately, I haven't had to produce a yellow card yet.
So because they haven't attacked each other. Explain the yellow card system.
Right. So one, at the beginning of this contest, what we wanted to avoid was what has been going on in Parliament under successive Conservative governments, if you like, and successive Prime Ministers, which is immense backbiting against colleagues. We wanted to avoid all that. And so what we said was, look, if you do this and you're proven to be doing it, then we will literally issue a statement saying you've infringed the rules. Which will be detrimental to any candidate, obviously, in terms of the election. I'm a football fanatic, and so therefore, yellow cards came into the whole idea. And the way they're given out freely at the moment in Premier League games, well, you know.
Given that there's a bit of cut, you know, politics is a game of cut and thrust, do you not want someone who will do whatever it takes to win? Might do in this race they would do in a general election?
Well, I suspect, I don't know. Yeah. Obviously, whoever's elected out of these four, the other three will certainly be seeking to serve in their the party leader's shadow cabinet. So if you spend your whole time attacking each other, you're not going to trust each other when you actually get around the shadow cabinet table. And what we want to do is make sure that whoever is elected leader has rolled out their policies and explained those to the party membership, which we're doing over these 4 days, then explain them to parliamentarians and make sure that they accept what they're doing by voting for the leader of their choice. And that person, whoever he or she may be, we hope and expect to lead us through this parliament and then back into government. And so it's important that actually we don't start knocking each other. We should actually be knocking the Labour Party. And there's plenty to knock.
We'll come to that in just a moment, Bob. I just need to bring you a little bit of breaking news. The Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, has told colleagues in government in writing today that he's leaving his post at the end of the year. And the government is starting the process to find his successor. It's been known for some time he's been suffering from health problems and was off work, and he came back early this year. But he's confirmed that he will leave his post at the end of the year. What do you think his legacy will be, having been in government?
Well, he's guided successive governments. Mm. And I think one of the things that you expect from the secretary in that respect of impartial advice, giving it to not only the Prime Minister but also to the whole of the Cabinet, and actually staying out of the headlines, not being in the headlines, not being the news. It should be the politicians that make the decisions after they're given proper advice. So I think his reputation has been very, very well held and very sound for giving appropriate advice. Or whoever is following him is going to have a hard act to follow.
Let me just take you back to the leadership race. Mm. Some of the candidates have said it is going on too long. They would like to be the one at the dispatch box responding to the budget on October the 30th. Yeah. It's a huge moment for the budget. I mean, the strange thing about the Labour Party conference last week is that the most uttered phrase there was, you'll have to wait for the budget.
Yeah.
It's a huge moment. Would it not make sense for the new Conservative leader, because it's the leader of the opposition who responds, would it not make sense for the new Conservative leader to respond to the budget rather than Rishi Sunak as his sort of last act before he packs up?
Well, we had lots of representations in Parliament before I determined the process. Some people wanted it short, so we'd get it over and done with before the summer. Some said, let's have an interim leader and let's stretch it out into 2025. In the end, I thought that the best process was to get four candidates to the party conference, which, you know, isn't huge numbers of people, but it's enough that actually that members can see the runners and riders who are the serious players who can become the leader. After that, obviously, we've got to slim down the number to two and then issue letters to all our members to enable them to vote. The problem about bringing forward the date is that you concertina that period of time, and there's a risk that members don't all get the chance to vote. And I think that was the main concern that we had. So we set the agenda and the timetable. We'll announce the new leader on the 2nd of November. I think actually the worst speech you can ever make in Parliament is the leader's speech responding to the budget. And I think Rishi owes it to us in the party and to the country. Having been Chancellor and having been Prime Minister, he knows those decisions that are going to be made, so he can respond to that literally as his farewell, and then our new leader can take us through that budget process as we're going through and implementing it, remember.
But isn't it a bit odd that this huge political moment, the new Labour government's first budget, the thing they've told us to wait weeks and weeks for, we get one Conservative response on one Wednesday, and then you're going to get a new leader who might take a completely different approach?
I very much doubt they'll take a different approach, because I think from what we're hearing, the rumours about this great budget that's going to happen is going to be a rise in taxes, a rise in spending, a rise in borrowing. You can almost map it out for what it is at the moment straight away.
That sounds remarkably like the last few years of the Conservative government, where spending and taxes went up.
Well, funny enough, we had this little thing called COVID that we had to deal with. But there we go. That's one of the problems. What we've got to do is obviously respond to that budget and then set out our alternative. And Jeremy Hunt, as Shadow Chancellor, will lead the debate on the budget the day after and set out the alternative. And then, of course, the decision-making will be left to the new leader.
While we've been talking, actually, some words have been coming in from Robert Jenrick, one of the candidates, speaking at a PopCon event. He said the new leader should be in place for the budget. As the Conservatives have got to sock it to Rachel Reeves and Labour, and it should be the new leader who does it.
I'd be interested to know what he would say if he's not elected as leader, whether he thinks that it should be an alternative. But at the end of the day, we decided on a process.
And you want to stick to it. In fact, Kemi Badenoch's been asked about exactly the same thing. She says, I don't think changing the date of the contest looks good. It looks like we're not serious. We've got the date, she said. The public are tired of us blowing with the wind.
Correct.
And so are you backing Kemi?
No, I'm not backing anyone, as you know. I'm completely independent, impartial on this leadership contest. Good try.
We had your predecessor, Graham Brady, on the show last week.
Right.
Talked about his book,
yep.
His time at the 1922 Committee. Yep. Are you keeping notes for your memoirs?
Well, let me tell you, I've been the secretary of the 1922 for 9 years during the time of his Graham was chairman. I have the notes of every single meeting we've held of the 1922 committee and the executive committee. So I've got the exact details of what everyone said during those meetings.
So that sounds like you are writing.
Well, I might well do. Well, eventually. I've got a long time to go yet.
How big is the safe? Have you got your own safe? Or do you inherit the safe?
Not yet, no. Graham took it with him.
Oh, so you need to get a new safe.
Yeah, but the new leader
is
safe from confidence votes for a year after he or she is elected. So nothing will happen until...
There'll be no unrest in the Tory party for at least 12 months.
Absolutely, because we are one happy, united force, because we're concentrating on the enemy, the Labour Party, who, after all, are making a complete mess of things far quicker than we expected. And we thought this would all fall apart at some stage. I didn't expect it all to fall apart.
Keir Starmer still lasted longer than Liz Truss.
Only just.
good to see you, Bob Lapman there, chair of the Conservative, the 1922 Committee, who is running the leadership in completely ruling out the idea of bringing it forward. So it's definitely going to go all the way to November the 2nd. Thanks very much, Bob. Right, we have been looking for a member of Matt's Parliament in Solihull West and Shirley, who is going to get the certificate and the rosette. We've got some calls. Who's on the line? Hello?
Hello. Hello. Simon.
Hello. Hello, Simon. Where are you right now, Simon?
Well, I'm in Truro in Cornwall, but my mother and my nan are from Shirley.
Oh, so you've got a family connection. Is it a nice place?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a nice place. I used to have many holiday breaks there with my nan.
Nice.
And we used to go all over the show into Sully Hall itself. Back in the 1970s, Sully Hall used to have this really terrible water feature in the middle of the town. I think it's gone now, but it was ghastly.
Why was it so bad?
Oh, it was just sort of, I don't know, sort of after the war and just grim, really. But one of my abiding memories of being in Sully Hall was going to concerts. My mum used to drag me to recitals and classical concerts. I just couldn't stand them. It was absolute torture.
You don't sound like you're a very big fan of this. Let's bring in Scott. Scott, where were you and what's your connection?
Well, I'm actually in Birmingham, just across the border. A good footballer could get a ball into Sully Hall from where I live.
Very good.
I work in Sully Hall and have for the last 15 years. I actually worked for the local authority, so if that ups my game or not. You were talking about Landovers. You didn't know Landovers made in Sully Hall.
Yes.
And then
yeah.
Mr. Street informed you. It was quite amusing because I'm originally from Canada and have chosen the Midlands as my home now.
I think we might give it to one of our callers from earlier on. We've run out of time. It's all gone so quickly. I'll see you tomorrow live from the Toy Party Conference in Birmingham. But stay tuned. Drive's next on 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Hello, yes, welcome to Drive on 5 Live, 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon. Claire McDonnell and Johnny Iansen. Here's your news headlines. It's reported Israel has said it's intending to start a limited ground invasion into Lebanon as soon as today. CBS News is quoting a US official just hours after Israel's defence minister, Yoav Gallant, met troops near the border. Downing Street says the government remains supportive of Israel, but it's continuing to call for restraint from both sides. The Shadow Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, has told 5 Live he thinks the government's striking the right balance.
It is clear that Israel has the right of self-defense. Hezbollah has been lobbing rockets and missiles across the border into northern Israel, and Israel is defending its people, tens of thousands of whom have had to move south. It's defending its people from those rocket attacks.
Hezbollah's deputy chief says they are ready to respond. The BBC has apologised to Amanda Abington and upheld some of her complaints against her Strictly Come Dancing partner Giovanni Pannicci, but cleared him of the most serious allegations. It's understood while complaints of verbal bullying and harassment were upheld, claims of physical aggression were not. He has always denied the allegations. Our media editor Katie Razzle has been looking into each of their reactions.
She has said, it's vindication of my complaint. I'm very happy about having an apology. It means a great deal to me. A spokesperson for him, for the Mail, was quite on the front foot, said, you know, he's relieved that the overwhelming majority of allegations, the BBC decided to uphold some allegations to avoid the accusations of a whitewash.
Disciplinary action is going to be taken against four Metropolitan Police officers and a member of staff over how they handled allegations against serial rapist David Carrick. The former officer was handed at least 30 years in jail in February last year. One of the Conservative leadership candidates, Tom Tugendhat, says he'll work to rebuild trust in the Tories following July's election defeat. He's made his pitch to replace Rishi Sunak at the Conservative conference in Birmingham and was followed by fellow contender Kemi Badenoch. The two other candidates, James Cleverly and Robert Jenrick, will get their chance to speak tomorrow. The UK's top civil servant, Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, has announced he'll stand down at the end of the year. He says it's on health grounds. And passengers on the Villa V residences